Buzzkillers, I'm so stoked that our podcast, Professor Buzzkill, and the Buzzkill Institute are sponsored by HelloFresh, the greatest meal delivery company in the entirety of world history. HelloFresh is on a mission to bring cooking back into your lives with real, whole, healthy ingredients that you can feel good about. They do all the shopping, all the planning, and they deliver their wonderful meals right to your door. HelloFresh recipes include step-by-step instructions and the absolute best ingredients, so you can relax and enjoy all there is about cooking. Let me repeat that, Buzzkillers. They plan, they shop, you cook. So go to HelloFresh.ca and use the code Buzzkill50 to get 50% off your first box. Do it now, Buzzkillers, and say hello to a fresh new life.
This is Gregory Rasputin, spiritual advisor to Tsar Nicholas and Empress Alexandra. I was having a night on the town when jealous henchmen from royal court put a couple bullets in my back. Fortunately, Professor Buzzkill was there to minister to me and heal my wounds. Professor Buzzkill pays no heed to my teachings, but I am stoked beyond measure that his new episode is here. Slip on a bulletproof vest and listen with me.
Yes, here we are with Professor Marie Hicks from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who's going to talk to us this Valentine's Day week about the history of computer dating. How are you, Professor?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
We're doing pretty well, too. Here we're all snowed in, of course, but that's also a very common winter, February sort of situation. There's a standard story of how this, how computer dating started and how it developed, and it all sorts seems to have this locus around Harvard, around these whiz kids, these whiz boy male undergraduates, and that we find out that that's a myth. But let's talk about what it was and what people tend to think happened before we go on to bust that myth.
Sure. Yeah, there's this, like you say, this kind of popular myth that computer dating started at Harvard University, that Harvard University undergraduates came up with the idea and they had the first successful computer dating business called Operation Match. And then everything just kind of went from there. And that's a very cute little story. But it's a lot like something you actually might put on an online dating profile. It's something that maybe you think people expect to hear, that maybe people want to hear, but in fact, it isn't true. And for a long time, you know, folks didn't really question it because, like you said, we have so many of these stories where it's like, you know, boy genius this and whiz kid that. So we're just primed to hear those stories. But in fact, you know, I think the real history is more interesting because, as it turns out, computer dating didn't start out with college students and it didn't start out with young men doing it.
What years are we talking about? What
we're
years
talking,
for the start? Well, at least for the Operation Match myth, and then later on, what really happened? The 50s or the 60s or the 70s?
We're talking about mid-century, height of the mainframe era. So we're talking about the 1960s, and specifically what we're going to talk about today is the mid-1960s, which is when computer dating kind of really gets going as something that is something that can become a business. Now, there had been kind of one-off situations where folks had tried to use computers to match people up for, like, dances and things like that. And that had been kind of a popular gimmick in Europe, even before the stuff that we're going to be talking about. But this specifically, what we're talking about today, is when computer dating comes into its own as a business, and people start to see, oh, we could actually make money off of this.
Now, there had been matchmaking services before this, and there are obviously, you know, famous matchmakers that claim to be able to pick out people for you that did it sort of, you know, personally and individually, not through, or at least not advertising it through computers. But this is something new.
Yeah, there had been stuff like this going on without computers for a long time. And I always like to draw in some of the continuities because, like you say, it isn't something that's radically new. You know, it's using a different kind of technology. but technology had been all bound up in matchmaking for decades, if not centuries. You know, people using newspapers to place personal ads, people using postal mail to communicate with, you know, their paramours, people having sex in cars. That was obviously a huge thing by the mid-20th century, especially in American culture. So, you know, technology is always part of matchmaking stories and romance stories. You know, you don't have to look too far for it. So computers in some ways were just a natural evolution of that. But you're right that at the time, because a lot of people didn't really understand how computers worked, it sort of had this veneer of newness, like, oh, you know, how does that work, right? How did that happen? And so maybe it had a little bit of a veneer that it was something revolutionary, when actually it was, you know, it was just sort of an evolution.
And the idea that computers, you know, were so smart and ran calculations through so many times that, you know, they couldn't get it wrong.
Yes, I think that's a really, really important part of this whole myth, which, you know, we still fall for today when we're, you know, using online dating apps and things like that. This idea that somehow computers or computerized systems have better judgment than people do, and that they take in all this data and that they can somehow use logic to make correct decisions about highly illogical things.
Yeah, that's right. So really, who was the first person to really start this off, or how does it actually start off as computer dating as we would know it eventually?
Well, computer dating as we would know it doesn't actually start off with the Operation Match guys at Harvard. They come around and start running their, you know, first computer dating matchups in around 1965. And they go on to do this for a couple of years. They get a lot of publicity, but as you might expect with students who are just kind of doing this, you know, they're doing it as a business, but also kind of as a LARF, you know. Their business doesn't last very long. And what actually is the case in terms of, you know, the first computer dating business, which is operated for over a decade, that actually starts a year or so earlier in England. So in the early 1960s, a woman from East London, who's kind of, you know, she's kind of not what we imagine when we think about tech pioneer, because she's a woman, she's kind of working class, you know, she's from this sort of hard scrabble background. She sets up what was in that day called a marriage bureau, and then very quickly she computerizes it. And in 1964, so like a full year before the Operation Match guys even start doing their thing, she is successfully running a computer dating business, and she even changes the name to reflect the fact that she's focusing on matching people up by computer.
Oh, okay. So the old name, or sort of the traditional name of marriage bureau, thinking of eventually starting dating, that it would eventually obviously lead to marriage in the 50s and 40s and 30s before that. She feels that it has to, at least the name has to be sort of updated to reflect computers and make it more, I don't know, snappy or technologically cool.
Right. So she had a marriage bureau that was called the St. James Friendship Bureau. And very quickly after she starts using a computer to make matches, she changes the name twice, in fact, once to the St. James Computer Matchmaking Bureau, and then again to COMPAT, which is short for Computerized Compatibility. And she's very much pushing out into the forefront of her, you know, marketing, the fact that her service works and works better, she says, because she's using computers. And she takes a really interesting tack with this as well, because she's not saying, like some folks who come a bit later than her do, she's not saying, oh, look, this makes everything so, you know, wonderfully logical, and it finds you, you know, the perfect match. She's saying that, look, this is a way to manage all of the folks that are looking for other people. The volume of those people is just so high that we just need a computer to kind of help us sort out the data. It's not necessarily about, oh, computers never make mistakes or anything like that, but it's about, you know, scaling up this kind of bespoke process of making matches. And the thing that I really like about her is that she doesn't say, okay, what do you want? And we'll find you somebody else who, you know, is the same or wants exactly the same things, which is what most computer dating businesses do, even today. What she kind of says is she says, what's a deal breaker for you? Tell us what you don't want. You know, we'll still take into account what you do want, but tell us what you don't want, because we found that that's the deal breaker. Everything else is negotiable. And I think that's very interesting and very shrewd. And as we might talk about later, it really reflects who's using her business and how they're navigating their way through society.
And did she come up with this sort of negative approach to asking what you don't want because of her experience with you know, her old you know, St. James Marriage Bureau? You know, did she kind of figure it out on her own, or had there been thoughts before in the, I don't know, in the psychological press, if you will, that one of the things that works in matching up people or in finding people of similar interest is that you find out what you don't like?
That's a really interesting question. And I don't know what, you know, psychologists were maybe saying at the time about compatibility. But I do know that if they were saying stuff like this, she wasn't aware of it. She was, like you said, coming up with it from having had experiences matching up folks in a non-computerized setting and figuring out what worked when she did that sort of thing. And so she found out that, you know, yeah, commonalities work well to set people up maybe once or twice. But if you want something long term and you want to make sure people maybe don't keep coming back to you month after month for new dates and new matches, but they actually have a long term relationship, or, you know, in this period, the goal was still to get married for most people. If you want that, then you should look for the deal breakers and be very upfront about, you know, well, what is it that's really going to, you know, three or four dates down the line make somebody say, I'm out, I can't do this.
Well, and there must be something sort of intuitive about it, because after all, as you go through life, you end up deciding against far more things than you decide for. You know, I decided against a zillion professions and went with one, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So in other words, our dislikes, and I don't mean that in a bad way, are much greater in number than our likes.
Yeah, exactly. And so many times, you know, even in our personal lives, and especially in our professional lives, as you point out, we use this process of elimination, you know, because nothing's perfect. Mm-hmm. And we decide, well, what is it that we absolutely can't tolerate? You know, the rest we can maybe get used to. And I think that's really actually kind of a nice, you know, maybe it's not very romantic. It's always nicer to think like, oh, I'll meet my soulmate and it'll be absolutely perfect. And it'll, you know, a computer will give me my soulmate. I mean, that's that would be a nice fantasy. But then there's also something like the pragmatist in me really likes the idea that, well, no, it's really not that complicated. You just, you know, you just figure out what you absolutely cannot tolerate. And then from there, you know, you come to an understanding with the other person. Like, you don't try to find that perfect person who, honestly, if they're just like you, that's going to be really boring.
Almost immediately.
Exactly. So you have somebody that you don't want to murder straight off the bat, and then maybe you have a long relationship, or at least, you know, a shot at a long relationship where you get to know them better. And that to me is kind of more interesting than, oh, kismet, you know, we knew right off the bat, we loved each other, whatever.
Yeah. So how did it work? How did Joan Ball make it work? Did people fill out a form? Did they write in a letter? How did she gather the data or the info that she needed?
Yeah, they could do it by mail, or in this case, you know, since it was London and people were transiting through London anyway, yeah, a lot of folks would just come into the office in person.
All right, right.
And they would basically be given or administered a questionnaire. And that questionnaire would ask them things about their likes and their dislikes and their age and their background and all of these same sorts of things that, you know, honestly, you'd answer in sort of like an online dating service like Match.com or what have you. Pretty similar questions. And then somebody would take that data, they would put it on a punch card or maybe several punch cards, and that would be run through their computer dating program, or as we like to call them now, you know, computer dating algorithms. But essentially, you know, it would be put into a big data pile with a bunch of other punch cards representing people who had signed up for the service, and then people would be matched up.
Okay, and then you again, you were given their names, or how what sort of, you know, this is way before the smartphone and the swipe right, swipe left thing. How do you get in contact with your supposed paramours?
I know, that's so interesting, right? You might not even necessarily get somebody's phone number. You might just get an address. You know, the way you met them first could be by phoning them, or it could be that you wrote to them or they wrote to you.
Hmm. Yeah, people forget, and I'm sure a lot of our younger listeners won't realize that, you know, back in these days, people had, you know, one phone in the house, if they had that, especially in England at the time. And it wasn't exactly, you know, people still communicated by letter.
Yeah, and the post came twice a day in
That's
most
right.
parts
yeah.
of the country. Yeah. So, you know, it was almost like, oh, okay, if you're going to check your email twice a day or you're going to check your physical mail twice a day, it was a pretty quick way of communicating. And one thing that I always like to mention when people talk about computer dating being, you know, maybe a little bit untoward, or even, you know, it's not so much the case anymore, but within the past decade, people would look at online dating and they'd say, oh, it's going to be the end of everything. You know, they'd have this sort of moral panic about it. And I'd say, well, you know, in the late 19th, early 20th century, there was a similar moral panic about a technology that people were using to kind of meet each other and arrange, you know, perhaps illicit encounters between unmarried young people. And that moral panic was about postal mail. The idea that, you know, young women, for instance, could receive direct communication from young men in the mail that their parents wouldn't know about or vet in advance. And that was a huge moral panic. So, you know, nothing is ever kind of as revolutionary or scary as we might think.
Do we have any idea of how well or how well the matchmaking part of the service worked? Was she able to kind of prove, or at least to herself, that the, you know, using the deal breaker algorithm and the postal service and all that sort of stuff ended up finding a lot of matches?
Well, that's the really interesting thing about her model. Because it really was focused not just on sort of matching people up for dates and then saying, okay, it's in your hands, because it was really focused on trying to get people into long-term relationships. And the reason for this was that her marriage bureau actually served a clientele of older folks than you might think would be going in for like computer dating. So there was folks who were a bit older. A lot of them were divorcees, so divorced women,
right.
In particular, also some divorced men. There were widowers, you know, who were not necessarily, you know, very old widowers, but people who were not, this wasn't their first time at the rodeo, right? And they wanted to have some help matching up with other people, because essentially, you know, I think this is still the case, but especially back then, folks like that were seen as damaged goods.
And that's right. That's right.
Within the very kind of straight-laced social mores of the time, they needed a bit of help to kind of find other people who would accept them and sort of see past, oh, okay, you've been divorced, and be interested in getting into potentially another, you know, marriage with them. And so since she was focusing on a crowd like this even before her business computerized. She was very savvy about making matches that worked. And it wasn't just a gimmick about, well, we'll use a computer to match people up on dates, which honestly, that was kind of, you know, for understandable reasons, that was the case with a lot of other early computer dating businesses, especially ones headed by young men who are right out of college, because they just, you know, their experience wasn't the same. It wasn't coming through having experience matching people up. It was coming up with this, oh, hey, we have a brilliant idea to use a computer to kind of take some of the messiness out of meeting women. And I think it should be said that a lot of the young men who set up computer dating businesses in this era and later, they were setting them up initially because they wanted a way to find dates for themselves without having to go through traditional channels. Like the Operation Match guys were very vocal about the fact that they were setting up Operation Match because they absolutely hated what they called the particular social evil of the college mixer. You know, so at Harvard, there's the sister college, Radcliffe. Right. And so they'd go up to Radcliffe for like a social mixer, and it would be terrible and awkward, and they wouldn't come away, you know, having met somebody or meeting somebody that they liked. And they never wanted to have to go through that process again. So they were like, well, how can we get a computer basically to just kind of serve us women, which is interesting, it's clever, it's also a little bit creepy and problematic.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Because, like, for one thing, this was a period in which, like I said, women were all sequestered at Radcliffe, kind of up the road from the young men.
Right.
And it was a period, I actually wrote my undergraduate dissertation when I went to Harvard on this topic. Uh-huh. It was a period when Harvard was trying to integrate the genders and basically have what they called full co-education and full co-residence. So women and men.
We should remind our listeners that Harvard was all male until the 70s. Yale was all male until the 70s. You know, and this is not, you know, and that's why Radcliffe, one of the reasons why Radcliffe existed, right? The old school universities in the United States were all male.
Right. And they were very conservative, even though they had their coordinate sister colleges. They were very late to integrate. And so Radcliffe women would be educated in the same lecture halls as Harvard men. But then at night, they would go back to their own dormitories. They would have their own dining halls, their own libraries, all of the places where you might actually like get to know somebody on a college campus. Those were gender segregated. And Radcliffe students in particular were very upset about this because this meant that, for instance, they couldn't use the main undergraduate library at Harvard.
Right, because which sounds so bizarre to us nowadays, but it wasn't that long ago.
It wasn't that long ago. And I mean, I remember when I was an undergrad there in the 1990s, of course, I could use the main undergraduate library. It was fully gender integrated at that point. But there was one women's bathroom, and there were like six men's bathrooms. And that was a clear artifact of this gender segregated past.
Okay, well, before we get into how things worked at Harvard and how Operation Match got going and fully and all the technical details of how it worked, we have to take a quick sponsorship break, and we'll be back in a minute. Okay, here we are on our sponsorship break, and I want to tell you, Buzzkillers, HelloFresh solves the age-old problem, what's for dinner? And they solve it for all types of people. Say you've got a young family. Lady Buzzkill and I had this problem a lot. We almost never planned meals, or we left it to the last minute, and by mealtime, the Buzzlings were running around like crazy doing their own thing. We'd make something quick and thoughtless, and half the time, they didn't eat it because they're picky, they're kids. And we'd get frustrated. Well, we don't have this problem anymore. HelloFresh has solved all that. They do the planning and the shopping, and they send us great meals made of healthy, locally sourced ingredients. The Buzzlings love them. And we get them involved in the preparation because of the clear instructions that HelloFresh includes. The kids are becoming little chefs. And you know what we're becoming? Super parents. Because we provide them with the healthy home-cooked meals they need and they love. Go to HelloFresh.ca and use the code BUZZKILL50 to get 50% off your first box. Do it now, Buzzkillers, and say hello to a fresh new life. Okay, we're back with Professor Marie Hicks talking about the history and development of computer dating. Before we left, Professor, you were talking about Operation Match, which is often considered the innovator of computer dating. Now, we've talked about how that wasn't the innovator, but you also talked about how it sort of worked with and kind of worked against the gender segregated nature of Harvard at the time. Could you explain more about how that, you know, how all that sort of in detail, how it kind of cranked its way through the computer, so to speak?
Yeah, well, I think that it's important to remember that the whole reason, for instance, Operation Match gets started is because these young men not only are having trouble meeting women because Harvard isn't fully coeducational, but they don't want Harvard to be fully coeducational. People say, oh, it'll be easier to meet women if, for instance, they are in the same dormitories and they eat in the same dining halls. And these young men in particular, they're very conservative. They say, no, we don't want that. So they're using this computer system as sort of an end run around greater gender integration that might have gotten them the same results in a more organic fashion. And that's really important, actually, because, for instance, at this point in time, you know, separate but equal for women versus men or for white people versus black people, it was never really equal. Women lost out. Black people lost out. They got put in colleges and hospitals and schools and everything that were under-resourced. And so computer dating is, you know, not only is it not revolutionary in this context, but it's actually kind of re-upping very conservative ideas about how, for instance, men and women should act in society. Uh-huh. And the fact that this computer dating service is like just for college students and primarily, you know, is focusing on a white male user's needs and desires, that's not an accident. And there's also nothing revolutionary about that.
Oh, right, right. Okay. I mean, it kind of makes me wonder as I'm listening to you explain this, you know, I know now what you said that they set this up partly, or at least mainly to get dates for themselves. But when they talked about it as a potential business, why they didn't think about abandoning the university situation and try to, you know, create an Operation Match for Greater Boston?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, in a way, I think they were very savvy. They understood that by focusing on university students, they would be going for a market that they understood because it was essentially themselves. And they would have a lot of built-in publicity because they could basically like go on campus and hand out flyers. They sent people around the country to other universities in the second and third years that they did this. You know, they went to big Midwest universities and they sort of did the same thing with papering campus with flyers and advertisements. So it was kind of a nice way to start slow and to sort of have training wheels into this business venture. And it turns out that they never really got beyond that. But I think it made sense to focus on college students, even though that was pretty conservative. I should mention that with Joan Ball in England, in many ways, she is doing similar things. Like, she's being pretty conservative in how she matches people up. You know, she's not like, for instance, matching up a lot of people of different races. That was something that, you know, she thought was not going to result in a good match at that time. I mean, there was enormous racism and classism during this period that meant that a lot of people who went into these systems or maybe didn't even decide to use these systems because they knew they wouldn't get a fair shake. You know, there were these problems of social prejudice and conservative social mores being built in to computer systems. But the reason that I mention that is because in Joan Ball's case, because she's not this sort of like scampish young Harvard student who can do no wrong, she actually has a tough time like advertising her business early on because people hear computer dating and not only are they maybe a little bit squeamish about the prospect of a computer, but they think that it might be a front for, like, prostitution.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And in fact, newspapers, they don't want to take her advertisements for her business because they think there's something a little bit, maybe a little bit iffy, a little bit morally off about this whole idea that it's actually not doing exactly what she says it's doing. It's maybe like, you know, a wink, wink, nudge, nudge sort of thing. Yeah. And so because
she gets all their personal information that she can then presume, in theory, use illegitimately.
Exactly. And we should totally talk about that later in relation to Compat's successor, Dateline. But what she does, because newspapers won't take her ads early on because of this sort of, you know, fear that maybe she's not doing exactly what she says she's doing, or she's doing something untoward, she starts advertising with the Pop Pirates, which were these pirate radio stations that played rock and roll off the coast of the UK. They couldn't transmit within the country because basically the government and the BBC controlled what could be played on the airwaves. Well, they wanted to play rock and roll, and so they went off the coast and set up transmitters on these kind of rickety floating barges and these old ships, and people would tune into them, especially at night when the interference was lower. And one of the things that they did to keep themselves literally afloat is they took advertisements, and they took her advertisements. So she actually, you know, she advertised in this very technologically advanced way for the time, using pirate radio to get her message to the people initially. And then as time goes on, she does kind of get the ability to advertise in more and more, you know, kind of respectable venues and newspaper venues.
And the Buzzkillers should know that, if they don't know that, that was a pirate radio was a very big deal in the 60s and early 70s in Britain, because of exactly what you say. A lot of things couldn't be played, or it was too difficult. You know, the time slots couldn't fit. They didn't get enough rock and roll. And so Radio Luxembourg from way back when, and then and Radio Caroline in the 60s were a very, very big deal. The Beatles talk about a lot about how that Radio Caroline especially really boosted their popularity.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it was more so than like computerizing dating. I think the pop pirates are this really good example of, you know, the cultural tensions of the time and the cultural shift that's going on, with people saying, no, this is the sort of culture we want.
Right, right, right. And the establishment radio, establishment, you know, show business is very, very slow to catch up.
Yeah, yeah. And in the case of computer dating, you know, the establishment does start to catch up. Like I said, more and more legitimate, you know, venues, respectable newspapers start to take Joan Ball's ads. And by the late 1960s, you know, things are really going gangbusters for her. She's doing a lot of business. Thousands of people are using her matching service, and she's having a lot of success. You know, she actually talks about one man who comes back, and he's, you know, he's been matched up. It's been a year or so, and he comes back, and he's very upset, and he wants his money back. And this was quite unusual. They didn't really get people coming back and saying, you know, we need another matchup, or we want our money back, or things like that. And she says, well, I'm so sorry, you know, of course, what happened? And he says, well, you know, I met a woman through your service, and we got married, and, well, she died.
Like, as if Joan Ball's supposed to be not only match you up with a spouse, but keep that spouse alive.
Exactly. So, I mean, this shows that she had a pretty high rate of success. And it also shows how empathetic she was, because she hears this man's story. She realizes it's not about her, right? He's sad. He's angry that somebody that he probably loved has died so soon. And so she helps him, you know. I think in the end, she doesn't just give him his money back. She tries to set him up again, because she sees what's going on is, you know, it's sort of an artifact of his grief with the situation.
But as you point out in your articles about this, Joan Ball's business gets bought out eventually.
Yes. So the 1960s, things are going pretty well, especially by the late 60s for the United Kingdom, for Britain as a country. You know, they're finally really kind of recovering from the austerity of the post-war period, and their economy is picking up. And this is a tide that's lifting all boats, right? So she's doing very well. She's a very savvy businesswoman. I should mention that, like a lot of very smart people and savvy business people, she actually is dyslexic. And so she can't easily read and write. She can't even do numbers a lot of the time herself, because when it gets to having to write things down, whether they're numbers or words, her dyslexia simply is so severe that she can't do it. But she is doing a fabulous job running the business. It's just a little, you know, it's extra effort for somebody who dyslexic. And also in this period, it wasn't really understood. So she's hiding her dyslexia, you know? And so everything is actually going pretty well for her. She's overcome a lot. And then in the early 1970s, disaster hits, because what happens is the whole economy of the country just starts to take a major dive. And in fact, in the early 70s, there's this year where there are such intense labor strikes that the government has to effectively shut down for most of the week, simply because the coal miners who are providing coal to power, like the electrical grid, they're on strike so much that like the government can't function. And so all of this leads to like very real negatives for her business, because for instance, there's a big postal strike. And because so much of her business is done through the mail, through the post, a postal strike means that essentially her business comes to a standstill for the duration of that strike, and then it has to recover from it. And in this this sort of general atmosphere, remember I told you how, you know, she was having a lot of trouble advertising, but then she finally got into more respectable publications.
Right.
Well, the main publication that was advertising her business and that was bringing in a lot of business for her, they ended up making a mistake in her ad. Somebody transposed a couple of numbers in Compat's phone number. And so all of a sudden, there's this postal strike, and then there's this sort of like blackout. They're not getting any phone calls, and they don't know what's going on until they realize that this major advertisement has actually messed up their phone number. And they have to...
two punch of unfortunate developments.
Exactly. And so they have to scramble to get that fixed. And then one day, Joan Ball walks into the tube, the London Underground, you know, to take public transit.
Yeah.
And remember, she's been fighting so hard to get her ads into mainstream publications. And advertising in the tube is like probably the most mainstream thing you can do, right? Because it reaches literally millions of people every single day ride the tube. She walks through the tube, and all of a sudden she starts seeing all these ads for computer dating. She starts seeing all these ads for a company called Dateline. And she almost throws up. She can't believe it. Because suddenly she's seeing all these ads for a service very much like hers, and she never would have dreamed that it would have been possible for her to be able to place ads in a venue like the London Underground, given all of the pushback she had gotten for a decade.
So how does she react to that, both as a person and as a businesswoman?
Well, that's the thing. As a person, she's kind of shocked, and she's, like I said, she almost feels sick because she thinks, what's going on? How did this happen? You know, I have been working so hard, and all of a sudden, you know, this place where I was never allowed to advertise is plastered with ads from a competitor that has just come on the scene. And she comes to find out that this new company called Dateline, which was founded by a man named John Patterson, Interestingly, as a young recent college grad, he actually traveled to America and he saw Operation Match and the other computer dating service that cropped up at Harvard at the exact same time. He saw them in action and then he decided, right, I know what I want to do with my life. He went back to England and he started a computer dating business. And Patterson was very, very shrewd, to put it generously, and maybe to put it a little less generously, he was extremely unscrupulous. He was a businessman through and through, and he wasn't about making people necessarily happy. If they were happy, that was great, but he wanted to make money. Right. And what he did early on to get his computer dating business off the ground, you don't even have to talk about a veneer of sleaze. He actually did things like he took lists of the women who signed up for his computer dating business, and he presented them to men as though these women were prostitutes. And he said, you know, you pay a certain amount, I guarantee you'll have the night of your life with one of these women. And he actually was brought up on charges for doing that.
Oh, God. And so here's the problem, that now this kind of sleazebag is the competitor of Joan Ball.
Right. And he's doing very, very well because she's already kind of softened up the market for him, especially in terms of advertising. And he's, like I said, he's a very shrewd businessman. And after he gets brought up on these charges, you know, he pays his fine. I think he maybe had to do some minimal jail time. And he picks himself up and he keeps going. And his idea, which is a pretty smart idea, is, look, I just need to keep maximizing the pool of users, right? Because the more users, the more money. And also the more users, potentially the better matches you'll get. But in fact, what you see with his service is, even though it's very economically successful, he makes a lot of money, again and again, people who use it say, it doesn't work. I'm not getting, sometimes people weren't getting any matchups, and they would say, look, this is a scam. The government actually investigated his business and several other computer dating businesses for this reason in the 70s. And a lot of times people would say, look, I asked for certain things or I put certain things on my questionnaire, and I'm being matched up with people almost in a random way.
No thought going into it at all, yeah.
Exactly. And so one thing that newspaper reporters would always ask him was, they'd say, well, how does your program work? How does your algorithm work? And he would be very tight-lipped. He wouldn't say how it worked or justify if it worked. He would just say, well, even if nobody has anything in common in other respects, at least they have in common the fact that they've all signed up for Dateline.
Yeah, but that could mean anything.
Yeah. So he, you know, he was a very, very shrewd businessman. And what that meant was he was actually better able to weather this tough period as Britain goes into the 1970s, while meanwhile, for a variety of reasons, some are just bad luck, but some are sort of the general economic decline of the era. Joan Ball's a very successful business. You know, it's almost a decade old at this point. She actually is starting to see it become more and more difficult to pay off her bills, to sustain her business. And at a certain point, she just gets a bit desperate and she thinks, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah. Is it just numerically swamped by Dateline? Is that what's happening?
Well, I think
Dateline being unscrupulous and getting anybody and everybody and just meshing with randomly, It overwhelms the cachet of St. James Marriage Bureau her marriage service.
In a way, yes, but I think really it's more that Dateline was just kind of the last straw. You know, things had been going wrong because, like I said, of this general economic situation in the country. Their ad gets misprinted. They're running into a lot of bad luck, essentially. And then Dateline comes on the scene, and it is a very powerful competitor. And at a certain point, Joan Ball thinks, I'm tired of doing this. I'm worried that I'm not going to be able to pay my workers. She gets to the point where she thinks maybe she needs a change and maybe this is going to be too hard of a slog, maybe be unsustainable. You have to remember also that, you know, she comes from a background where she doesn't have the same sort of safety net as somebody like John Patterson, who comes from a wealthier family. He went to college. He got a degree in mechanical engineering. You know, he's doing all of this from a position of like far greater privilege socioeconomically. And also, you know, he's a man, and that counts for a lot at this time. Women didn't run their own businesses very commonly. They didn't manage other people very commonly. So, you know, I'm not saying he had it easy, but he certainly had it easier. And a lot of the obstacles that Joan Ball was hitting in this period, given her background, you know, maybe if her background had been a little bit different, maybe if she hadn't been a woman, it's possible she would have been able to get through them. But as it is, she realizes, look, I feel like this is the end of the line for me. And she and John Patterson knew each other because they were the two big dogs in computer dating in Britain. They were always interviewed for the same television programs, for the same newspaper stories. And he knows that she's his main competitor, even though Dateline is at this point getting bigger than her business. She's still a threat to his business and his profit. So one day, you know, she calls him and she says, look, I'm looking to get out. I have a small amount of debt, you know, £2,000 of debt for the business. I need to pay off my employees and so on. Would you be interested in buying my business essentially for the price of the debt? And he basically, I mean, he can't believe his luck. He races across London to sign the papers immediately. And that's how Compat ends. And that's how Dateline goes on to become the most successful computer dating business in the world. Up through the 1990s, it keeps going until 1997, when he actually he dies kind of in a gory way. You know, he was an alcoholic, and he ends up dead in a bathtub, probably from, you know, alcohol poisoning. But for the tail end of the 60s, through the 70s, through the 80s, and through most of the 90s, he's actually the number one computer dating business in the world.
Did they clean up their act in any way in terms of you know, providing actual matches rather than just, you know, matching by sort of gross numbers?
I think that it sort of depends on who you ask. It's right. Sort of a yes and no answer to that.
Yeah.
The more people who use the service, the messier the matches became, the harder it became to match people up well, because honestly, that requires a much more complicated computer program. And so, like I said, by the 1970s, he and all of the other computer dating businesses that are still around in the mid-70s, they're getting investigated by the British government for being actual frauds, for being scams that are taking people's money and not providing the product that they claim. So there's a lot of contention around this. But I will say that, you know, he does make his business, let's say, more respectable, you know, from the early days when he was essentially collecting women's names and then trying to sell those names to men as though the women were prostitutes, like implying, you know, that they were prostitutes.
Wow. So, well, I'll tell you what, let's take a station identification break for Buzzkill Nation, and we will come back and find out what happens, how this sort of Operation Match and other computer dating services wind up on this side of the pond. Okay, we're back with Professor Hicks on the history of computer dating. And Professor, before we had our break there, we talked about, or you talked about, how these two big companies in Britain sort of eventually ended up. How does Operation Match at Harvard and presumably and competitors and copycat businesses, how does all that develop in the U.S.?
Well, in the U.S., and with Operation Match in particular, you know, like I said, these were college students doing something that was like a bit of a LARF. And in fact, Operation Match, for all the publicity that it gets, and it gets national publicity because these guys are well connected. Mm-hmm. They have a friend, for instance, whose father is a producer on the game show To Tell the Truth. And she gets you know, national media coverage on this television show. So they have like this kind of very, you know, meteoric rise. And then within just a few years, they've shut down because they realize, well, look, this isn't just about getting ourselves dates. This is really hard work. This is a real, you know, business. This isn't necessarily what we want to do with our lives. And they actually go on and they have, you know, lives and careers that you might say are more in line with their, you know, their middle class upbringings, their Harvard pedigree. In fact, one guy, he goes on eventually actually to not only become a judge, but he's one of Ronald Reagan's nominees for the Supreme Court.
Oh, talk about Operation Match. Wow.
And I think what actually torpedoes his nomination is because somebody digs into his past and finds out that, you know, probably back in this period, he had smoked marijuana. And so they you know, kind of remove his nomination, or he doesn't take the nomination and go through all the rest of the vetting. So, you know, that's kind of a very short little story, much shorter in the case of Operation Match than in the case of Joan Ball and Compat, or in the case of John Patterson and Dateline. And then in the United States, there are also a lot of other little computer dating projects like this that get started on university campuses, a lot of times by college students, and they stick around for, in most cases, relatively short periods of time. Like I said, Dateline was the longest running of all computer dating businesses, and that takes us up through 1997. And if you think about it, 1997, 96 or so, that's when, at least in the United States, like the internet starts to really explode in a big way.
That's right.
And I mean, I remember back in the day, you know, right around that time in the late 90s, that was when, you know, a lot of my friends, and I tried it too, we were doing things like Yahoo Personals, and we were getting into computer dating that was online. And that was the beginning of the era that we're in now.
When we have presumably what seems like a million different companies, Match.com, OkCupid, I can't think of any other ones.
Yeah, and I think it's nice to actually tie in what's going on now with what we were talking about, you know, back in the 1960s, because just like we were talking about early computer dating companies not being really revolutionary, actually being quite you know, they kind of rolled a set of conservative social mores into this new technology, and they were much less revolutionary than we'd like to think. Well, that's still going on. You know, if you think about the ways in which so many computer dating sites, even today, but especially, you know, as they were getting started in the early 21st century, they only catered to straight people. They implicitly targeted people who were sort of, you know, middle class and white, because they were targeting communities that already had enough sort of wealth to access the internet in this way. You see that the same thing happens a lot, where technologies that we like to think are revolutionary, well, not only are they not revolutionary, but they're actually kind of confirming socially conservative patterns that we don't see because we take them for granted in a lot of cases. And, you know, within the past maybe 5 to 10 years, maybe even just 5 years, that started to change with more and more computer dating services and apps that explicitly are focusing on markets who, you know, aren't straight, aren't white, cater to genderqueer people. There's this new app called Thirst that's all about, it's created by women of color who mm-hmm. are queer, and it's pitched towards essentially genderqueer people of color. So, you know, it's taken us a while, like it's taken us many, many decades to unpack all of the conservative norms that were just kind of taken for granted and built in to these systems. You know, we talk a lot about algorithmic bias today. Well, that's
the biggest one.
That's an early form of algorithmic bias.
Does the fact that is that the internet is sort of this second era of computer dating have anything to do with why that's been cracked open? I mean, with internet-based dating, you can be not only more, I want to say, selective in your audience, right? You're catering to a certain type of person, or a person with a certain sexuality or whatever, but because the internet's so wide, your audience is huge. You see what I'm saying? In other words, Dateline and Joan Ball and Operation Match couldn't afford to be selective in their audiences, but now you can, and I mean selective in a positive way. You know, you're approaching certain groups and saying we're offering this service.
Yeah, definitely. The volume really matters. The volume makes a difference. I mean, even in the earliest days of computer dating, one of the things that made certain companies like John Patterson's Dateline so successful was that he just had a much larger user group. And, you know, there's that old line, like, if you're using something, if you're using a service and you're not exactly sure what their product is, that means you're the product.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, I hadn't heard that, but it's very good.
Right. I mean, it's something we have to think about a lot when we use like online media, social media today. Well, it sort of is an instructive idea for computer dating, both in the past and present, because honestly, what was happening was it wasn't necessarily that they were, you know, that a match or a successful match was the product. The most successful computer dating companies, the product was actually the people, you know? And a lot of times women and dates with women, that was positioned as the product. So we can, you know, we can say that larger user groups sort of lead to better outcomes. But are those better outcomes for the users, or are they just for the companies who are making money and advertising revenue and making a fortune off of the folks who are using the service?
Well, what I was thinking of before, though, was that the user group is, let's say the LGBT community in a certain area or a certain city for Operation Match in Boston would have been, well, they might have thought of it as being too small to be worthwhile to make money. But if you have the internet, then the LGBT community becomes massive in terms of absolute numbers. And so that's one of the reasons it's able to, I don't want to say things like fracture or one of the reasons it's able to specialize, yet also have a pool of millions of people.
Yeah. I think that's a really important point, that especially as we're talking about portions of the population, like, you know, the queer community, where, you know, folks in the queer community, we have just statistically fewer options. If you're looking at, you know, the entire world as the dating pool, or the entire, you know, community as the dating pool. And so, these online dating companies that, or not online dating companies, but online dating services attached to other internet services that start to crop up in the late 1990s online, they're really, really, in some cases, lifesavers for folks who are gay or lesbian or queer and are trying to find other people like them, sometimes for dates, sometimes just, you know, to find other people like them that they can hang out with. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think is important to remember is that because of the sort of free-for-all nature of the early internet, and, you know, we're only sort of seeing the end of that free-for-all era just now, there is less gatekeeping. You know, no longer do they have to really go through a Joan Ball or a Compat or a Dateline and a John Patterson or an Operation Match, they can put up their own profile, you know, on Yahoo Personals or whatever it is. And it might be kind of janky and it might not really match them up in any sort of complex way with people who are like themselves, but other people will scan those ads, see those ads, and it will expand the pool of possibility.
Well, as we like to do on this show, you've shown us the complications in the history of computer dating, the complications in the way personal relations over the internet now have become sort of more complicated. So thank you very much, Professor. It's been a wonderful episode, and happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day to you as well. And I'll just say that if folks want to read more about this, there's an article that I did for a magazine called Logic that is all about the details of this history.
We're going to put it on the blog post that's on the on ProfessorBuzzkill.com about this episode, so they can click on it and get right to it. And both articles, as a matter of fact, absolutely fascinating.
Well, thank you for having me again.
Thanks again for being on the show. Okay, Buzzkillers, we'll talk to you next week.